episode number one, coming to you from Cranberry Township, just outside Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm Nick Ledoux, and I'll be your host. This is my first podcast, so hope you guys will bear with me as I work out the kinks. This is being recorded on September 14th, although I'm not really sure when we're going to get it up on the site. We're in the process of redesigning, so this is going to be one of the first posts. I'm aiming to release this podcast weekly, Fridays, noon Eastern Standard. So, who am I, you might be thinking? Well, I'm a 32-year-old computer programmer, and I have plenty of skills which apply to our modern society, but when it comes down to, say, getting under the hood of a car, for example, I'm clueless. By doing this blog and podcast, I hope to bring you guys along in a journey of my quest to become a modern type Renaissance man. I'd love for you guys to learn and share with me and experience this journey. So I really want your feedback. Please comment on the blog at saveourskills.com or email me at nick@saveourskills.com. That's spelled N-I-C-K. And you can also just hit the feedback link on the left-hand side of the site. If you go to the website, you can also find my Twitter and Facebook pages. If you think this is a cool project, I'd really appreciate you guys hooking up with me on there. So this podcast is all about you guys. It's not a monologue, so I want you on the show. Let's hear about the interesting skills you guys have or unique projects you're undertaking. So I have a few cool topics coming up. I got a good friend of mine who's going to give me a rundown on building battery packs, which to me is the first step in understanding and leveraging alternative energies. And then I'm going to be talking to a local trail builder about building and maintaining trails, how to survey land and build them sustainably to prevent the erosion. You guys can also get on YouTube and watch me brew my first batch of hard cider. Check out the cider press that I built this past winter, and all you homebrewers can tell me about everything I did wrong. So if you guys want to school me on a topic, drop me a line at nick@saveourskills.com and let's chat. With all that being said, I'm ready to get into it. So I'm pretty pumped up to bring on our first guest ever, Dennis McClung from GardenPool.org. Dennis, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Nick. It's an honor to be on your first show.
Oh, that's great. Hey, for those who aren't familiar with your website, let's give them a rundown of what you got going on over there in Mesa, Arizona.
Okay, Nick. Well, basically what we did is we bought our first home last October, in October 2009, and it came with an empty swimming pool. And being the mindset that I am, I created a self-sufficient aquaponic urban greenhouse out of this old swimming pool. And we actually feed our family 365 days a year with the food that we produce in our swimming pool.
Do you guys grow, how much of your food would you say you grow?
Well, you know, we still go out and grab a pizza every now and then.
Sure.
in a survival situation, I'd say we could eat 100% definitely, no problem, comfortably with the food. Right now, I'd say 75% of our food comes from the garden pool.
Now, I understand you have some kids, right? So how do they deal with tilapia for dinner again?
That's a good question. You know, we get really creative with what we cook. Thankfully, tilapia doesn't have a real strong flavor, and it kind of takes on everything that you cook it with. So, well, essentially what we've done is we've replaced chicken and most of our meat with tilapia. We get creative. And then again, we trade, organic tilapia for our neighbors for, you know, other food that they've grown. So it works out.
So you guys pretty much have to deal with a lot of extreme heat there. I went and visited a friend in Yuma, which is a lot actually further south, and it was probably 120 degrees when I was there. And I looked today in your weather, it's 95 degrees. What are you guys doing to keep that place cold?
That's a good question. When we first came about our property, we would look around and we don't even have grass in our front yard because it can't grow. That's how hot it is here. So what we do is we created basically a microclimate inside of our pool by enclosing it with a greenhouse type. And we take advantage of shade cloths. We position our, we have a south wall. We take advantage of our thermal mass. And also we have a 3000 CFM swamp cooler, an evaporative cooler that also uses a recirculatory water system to keep it cool. And on the average, we're about 10 to 15 degrees cooler than the outside temperature. So it's actually more pleasant to be inside of our greenhouse than it is to be outside of it.
Well, I guess tilapia have more of a problem with the cold than the heat. Does it ever get really cold out there? Do you guys ever have to bring in supplemental heat?
Well, to be honest with you, it doesn't get too cold in Phoenix, but we have been known to frost. The nice thing is we have the greenhouse top, which really puts sunlight on the water for a good part of the day. So if the water stays pretty nice. You know, we might have to add some supplemental heat if it dips down pretty low, but hopefully we can run it off our what we have, our battery bank for our solar setup. So, basically, we can't let the water dip below 50 degrees. But, you know, realistically, it doesn't get that cold in Arizona. So it's actually a perfect fish for what we're doing. They originate from the Nile, the breed that we have. So the Nile has a very similar climate to Phoenix.
Are you guys doing any breeding right now?
Yeah, oh, definitely. We used to sell, you know, more fry to other people, but because we were trying to be self-sufficient, we really limited that quite a bit. The nice thing about the tilapia is from egg to full-grown, you know, pound and a half, nice-sized fillet fish is about 9 months. And every time they have babies, every 4 to 6 weeks, they can have up to 1,500 babies at a time. So we actually don't have to worry about breeding so much as we do population control. So we have a catfish, just a single catfish that eats, you know, up to fish up to half its size. So we know that if we put a fish in the pond, it better be large enough to survive the catfish. So we regularly use seine nets to pull out the smaller fry, put them in separate tanks, and then breed them in the separate tanks. And once they get a little larger, we put them back in.
So you guys don't segregate by sex. I guess I was reading online that a lot of people are in favor of saying have all males in their tank or something like that.
Right. There's, you know, ways you could hybridize your breeds to make a 90%, 95% male, which is good for commercial fishing, you know, commercial aquaculture. But for the system that I use that's self-sustaining, I want to have a nice, healthy mix of male and female. The only real benefit of having an all-male population is you can control, obviously, how many fish you have, but the male actually become a bigger fillet faster. But since I'm working on a more organic permaculture system, I want to have a natural male-female population, and we just take care of their babies as we need. If we want more, we separate the babies. If we don't want more, then we leave them in there and let the catfish take care of them. So.
And I guess one of the coolest things that struck me when I was looking at your website is that you actually had a grate over the pool where the chicken go to the bathroom right into the pool, and that's part of what the fish are eating, if I'm understanding correctly.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Mick. And we've had a lot of questions about why we do that. And in studying pond, creating a pond for tilapia aquaculture, they actually suggest using, you know, 6 inches of chicken manure on the bottom before you put the water in the pond to kind of, feed the algae. So we have the chicken over the pond, which directly, you know, wastes into the pond and it feeds the algae. Also keeps the chicken coop immaculate. We don't have waste on the floor, so you don't have to worry so much about salmonella. So it kind of solves two problems with one stone. It's very unconventional, I admit it, but it works for our system. We just have to monitor the ammonia and the nitrates and the nitrites, and we monitor that daily in the pond water, but we seem to be handling it very well, so it's working out for us.
And how exactly do you monitor it?
With test strips. There's simple test strips that pretty much monitor. And what's funny is the monitoring of the water are really the only chemicals we use in the entire setup.
Have you ever heard of the Arduino chip?
No, I haven't.
Programmable microcontroller that you can program to monitor things like that. Some people online have taken them and basically made automatic moisture sensing things to water gardens and things like that. Anyway, it's just a side note. Could you tell me a little bit about what black soldier flies? What are you doing with those?
Oh, good question, Nick. That's one of my favorite parts of our permaculture system. So basically, people ask me what I do with the fish scraps. Since we don't grow a whole lot with soil, I don't make a whole lot of soil compost with that. So what I do is I feed it to our black soldier fly larva. And it's, you know, basically the the grubs of the black soldier fly, and they eat pretty much anything we throw in there, fish scraps, any veggie scraps we have, anything that we forgot to eat. If it looks pretty gross, we throw it in there, and they eat it, they multiply, they lay eggs, it generates heat, it creates awesome, you know, fertilizer, compost. And then the grubs we feed to the chickens and the tilapia. And they're self-harvesting, so it's easier than growing earthworms because as they mature, they grow up the tube. They crawl up the tube and fall directly into our harvesting pit. So black soldier flies are very high in calcium, too, compared to your average earthworms or your average grubs. So very cool, self-harvesting, self-perpetuating feed supply for our chickens and our fish.
Now, is this something that you had to go out and purchase, or did you create an environment and attract the black soldier flies?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, I ordered them online. Although they say that we live in the right zone, that we could naturally attract black soldier flies, I just wanted to make sure that, you know, for my mind's sake, that I got the right fly and I wasn't breeding. You know, it was new to me, so I didn't want to attract the wrong fly, but the cool thing is once you get the black soldier fly established and you have a good colony going, it actually repels the common house fly.
Because there's a bunch of flies around my compost bin, and I was wondering how exactly would I tell if they were a black soldier fly.
Oh, yeah. Well, they kind of mimic another wasp. So it almost looks like a wasp.
Okay.
But they have black wings, and their larvae, they start white, but it ends up a dark brown color. So very distinct from the common housefly and their maggots, which is something you definitely, you know, probably
sure
won't want.
Now, are you doing any rain catch, or is that a pointless exercise in Phoenix?
Well, you know, that is next on my list of things to do. We probably should have conquered the water challenge first, but we are going to do a rain catchment and cistern system. And the nice thing is because my greenhouse is below grade, it's underground, is we can take advantage of gravity. So if we have a huge cistern with thousands of gallons of water sitting up here, we don't have to have a pump system to pump it down into the pool. So it kind of helps out. As soon as it cools off in another month or so, I'm going to be up on the roof working on a rain system.
Now, it looked like you're just in a typical suburban development. I assume you guys don't have an HOA or you have a very understanding one.
Yeah, we don't have an HOA. It's just a typical city urban lot, what we're working with. But using aquaponics, it's a lot more productive than conventional gardening and farming.
Sure.
We don't have the HOA, but because we have the website, we've had the media out here, and which means we have to deal with the public knowing what we're doing in our backyard. So, as an example, the first live broadcast we had, 3 hours later, the city code enforcers that I live in were knocking on my door wanting to see my backyard. And, you know, they didn't know it, but I've been calling them the whole time with small questions. So I knew everything was up to code, and sure enough, it was.
Well, that's why it's good to have documentation, I guess. You've had mostly good feedback from your neighbors?
Oh, yeah, it's been overwhelming. Everyone supports us. You know, I'm sure some neighbors might not like it, but I haven't had any complaints. We'll put it that way.
Now, you started any other smaller aquaponics systems? Not started, but inspired, I guess, in your neighborhood?
Yeah, I have. In the general area that I live in, people have been contacting me. There's not a whole lot of people doing full-blown aquaponics in the nation. It really isn't too mainstream at this point. Hopefully it will be. I think it's a great setup, but I've had a lot of people start the first garden this year. A lot of people start barrel ponics using 55-gallon barrels. A lot of people have reached out to me with interest in converting their pool. I've also started teaching aquaponics with the local Phoenix Permaculture Guild, and my home will be a part of their summer tour of sustainable homes. Excuse me, the fall winter tour of sustainable homes. So we've definitely reached out. I've had a lot of permaculture students want to donate their time with me just to learn the system that we have, which is fantastic because I could always use another hand. So the idea is definitely spreading in my neck of the woods.
Okay, so you said you could use another hand. So what does a day look like for you? What are some of the daily things you have to do to keep that thing running?
Well, daily maintenance is not too bad. As an example, probably 2 or 3 hours a day. You know, it definitely does take work, I'm not going to lie. It does take work and it does take commitments. You have to have someone watch it when you leave because, you know, one critical flaw could really, you know, create a snowball effect. So you have to be around for that. But when I do projects, that's when I could really use a hand. So what I would do is save up a bunch of materials, have a project going. Once I reach the material list, then I could call in the volunteers and we could all learn and do it together, such as like the rain catchment system we're going to do, or we're going to start home brewing ethanol with duckweed. So we have a lot of cool projects. It's just I wish I had a clone of myself to help me out. My wife has been very supportive, by the way. I'll have to give her 110% credit. She's been very supportive, very helpful. But we're open to students and anyone else who wants to give us a hand.
So is your system 100% closed loop as far as what you're feeding the fish, or do you have to bring in additional feed for your chickens or your fish?
No, part of our system, besides the black soldier fly, is duckweed, also known as water lentils. And that it's totally beneficial to our system. It feeds our fish what we don't supplement with black soldier flies, and it also feeds our chickens. It happens to aerate and purify the water as well. Mm-hmm. So it's like a perfect, the backbone of our system is the duckweed. And if you go to my website, gardenfall.org, it's actually the background of the website because it's that important to our system. So between, you know, grass clippings from the yard, duckweed, black soldier flies, algae, our fish and chicken have a very balanced diet. So it is a closed system. We don't put anything out, you know, a little bit of water here and there. But we use, like I said, 80% less water than conventional farming. So it is a closed-loop system. We recycle 100% of the water we put in and produce our own feed for our livestock.
So did you basically come out of the gate firing in all cylinders, or did you make any critical mistakes that you would kind of pass along to a beginner?
Well, Nick, it would be nice if I could say I had this huge master plan to begin with, but I'll be honest with you. I created the greenhouse structure 2 days after we closed on the home, and we had a huge empty greenhouse. So I didn't even know about aquaponics yet. I started growing in 5-gallon buckets doing container gardening, which worked fine during the fall, winter, but once it started warming up in Arizona, then I was watering probably, you know, 5-10 times a day. And I thought, this can't go on like this forever. So we switched to hydroponics. And conversion to hydroponics was very successful. We really enjoyed it, but it was getting expensive because every 2 to 3 weeks, Nick, we have to flush the water and we have to add new chemical nutrients. And that's, chemicals are store-bought. I'm not a master chemist that can do my own hydroponic solution. So we started to look for alternatives. It's more self-sufficient, and we came across aquaponics and, you know, found out that the environment I had was just perfect for aquaponics. And so we've been going aquaponics now, and we definitely won't try, you know, we might try other methods, but we're pretty sure that this is the way we want to be, so.
Yeah, I was considering starting a hydroponics in my basement because I have a bunch of grow lights, but now you kind of got me thinking that maybe aquaponics would be something that I could do in my basement. Mm-hmm. How would you go about, do you think you could describe like the basic steps of setting up like a small system out of, say, a fish tank or a barrel?
Sure. We actually have smaller scale setups that are separate from our closed network. And what we do basically is you take a fish tank, let's say you have a 30-gallon tank, you know, a nice size tank, and you can grow any fish you want to. Personally, I like to grow fish that I eat, so I would probably grow tilapia. They're great for it. But, you know, you can use goldfish or koi. You can sell the koi or whatever. So you have your fish, and basically you would have to have another area of grow bed. So let's say you have 30 gallons of water. You would probably need 30 square feet of grow area. And you would need a hydroponic medium, such as I use Hydroton. Kind of looks like Cocoa Puffs, but it's a expanded clay balls, and it's fantastic for what we're doing, neutral pH. And you could totally grow a lot of vegetables with just 30 gallons of fish water, believe it or not. And the cool thing is that you won't have to, you know, as long as you keep an eye on the nitrates and ammonia and so forth, you really won't have to change your water too much. So they kind of take care of each other. But definitely can be done on a smaller patio scale or basement, you know, closet project or something like that.
Yeah, because I wanted to possibly put a pond or something in my yard, but I'm worried about what I would do in the winter because there's no way. Well, at least maybe there is a way, but I'm not really sure what you would do on a stretch of 0-degree weather in northern Pennsylvania.
Oh yeah, I totally understand. I lived in Ohio, so I know how the winters are. I have heard of people using perch though in colder climates that are freezes.
Okay.
And so I do know that if you don't want to do tilapia, if you're worried about, you know, keeping it tropical, you can try. I think it's like a silver perch or something like that.
But maybe you could harvest some of the tilapia and then put a trout or a perch in there, and then keep a small amount of tilapia, which you could expand upon for the next season inside.
Oh yeah, that's a good idea. Take advantage of, you know, the tanks, and you could totally do it seasonal. Even if you just kept a couple tilapia, you know, like let's say 6 tilapia, very small ones around, by next season you'll have tons.
Right, because they breed prolific breeders. Excuse me. So, what are some web resources that you use when you're sort of trying to educate yourself on this? Is there like a forum you participate in or something like that?
You know, to be honest with you, I kind of went for some of the academic studies. There's the University of Arizona. They have a lot of great research with their I think it's an aquaculture department, but they specifically grow Nile tilapia with duckweed. So I went off a lot of their research. At this point, Nick, it's kind of like it's down to a formula. You know, it's down to a science. You could tell what size you have and, you know, what size of area you have to work with and formulate how much fish you should grow and how much vegetation you should grow. So I pretty much went off a lot of that. I created gardenpool.org to serve as a reference for people because it seems like you have to study a lot of aquaculture and you have to study a lot of permaculture, and so I kind of put things together on the site. We hope to really expand upon it, adding more YouTube videos and such to show people, you know, how do we catch our fish. I really, to be honest with you, didn't expect a lot of people to have seen my website. It was kind of something personal I made, and the concept, you know, spread like duckweed, I say. So,
well, that's the power of Facebook. That's where I saw it posted. So,
awesome. Yeah, now I'm just kind of just trying to play catch up to explain to everybody exactly how my system works. So I'm trying to add more content as I have time.
And I noticed that you had a live streaming Ustream video up in there in the right-hand corner of your website. So you can sort of see, maybe catch you doing your day-to-day operations in there.
Yeah, you might see me, you know, taking care of the chickens or falling in the pond or something like that. So, yeah, check it out. It's kind of nice. It's surprising how many people just sit there and watch it. But it's relaxing, you know. It's kind of like a Zen garden in the background of your computer, so...
Yeah, and you guys, there's really no odor per se that this environment produces, or do you notice a fish type odor? Or
well, I wouldn't say it's fishy, but to me it reminds me of being at a lake. You know, it's fresh. It's a total difference from the outside environment when you walk in. For one thing, it's about 50% humidity, so you notice that off the bat. You know, which actually makes you feel cool. With the wind blowing on you, so, but there isn't a real bad smell. Even by our black soldier fly harvester, you know, our compost bin, there's not a smell. It's an organic feel, you know, like you're in nature. So,
well, I guess when there's commercially raised fish, there's issues with mercury. How does this type of system address all the pollution and things like that?
Well, the nice thing is there is no mercury in our water. So because we don't have any toxins, we don't use any pesticides. I don't even use compact fluorescent bulbs near my garden pool. I switch to specifically LEDs because they don't have mercury. If I drop a bulb, I don't have to worry about it getting in the water. So I keep all the toxins out. If we did have mercury, however, the duckweed that we grow could actually, purify it up to 95% of the heavy metals, including cadmium and mercury and so forth. We just wouldn't feed the duckweeds to the fish. We dispose of it. But we don't have that problem because we don't have, chemicals in our water, so it's pretty organic. There have actually been, that I know of, one organic aquaponics setup that has actually been certified organic by the government, but I don't really want to pay for my backyard to have an organic certification.
I wouldn't either. You said you use LED lights. What exactly, what types of LED lights are you getting for in there?
What I have just for general lighting, because I run off of the solar bank, are light bulb, like a 60-watt equivalent LED bulb. So basically just replacement of your CFLs. They can fit, with a standard screw base that you would normal light bulb. So that way it keeps it easy for me. I don't have to buy a bunch of special equipment for my LEDs. But the average light bulb that I run burns about 1 watt compared to a 17-watt CFL or a 60-watt light bulb. So, if I have a 900-amp-hour battery, I could run that one light bulb for a very long time.
And you, where do you find those, on eBay?
I'll have to put a link to where I found them. I actually bought them local, but I try to shop local when I can. The only thing I did really pick up local was the tarp that I used, 20x40 UV-resistant tarp, but I actually put a link to where I found that on my website. So I try to support local business. I go to local homegrown hydroponics quite a bit here at Tempe. They're great. But, really support your local businesses. You'd be surprised what they have for you.
Now, your whatever you're running in there, is that 100% off-grid, or do you run in some power from your house?
We're running a little bit of power from our house. We have pretty much most of our major systems are off-grid with backup power support, if need be. So, we could pretty much go 3 days for the pumps, the filters, the bubblers, that type of stuff off grid, without sun if we need to. And if we need to, then we have the backup grid that's connected to our energy system. So really, the house power grid serves as a backup, Nick. So.
And of your vegetable stuff you're growing, what percentage would you say of it is just feed for your chickens and fish versus, vegetable matter that you're consuming?
Well, most of the vegetables, the true vegetables that we're growing, are for us. We pretty much just give them the scraps. Because we have the duckweed and the soldier flies, we really don't need too much extra for them. So I'd say 95% of the produce goes to my family. Most of it we eat, all of it, right up. But we do preserve what we can and, also give to friends and family. So there is no waste with our system. But the nice thing about the duckweed is it'll literally double every 4 days or so. So if I have 5 square feet of duckweed, I'll have 10 square feet of duckweed in a couple of days. So I never run out of that stuff so far. I actually managed to cover my pond in it at one point in time, but the fish just tore that up in a couple of days.
So how are you mitigating that heat out there beyond that cooler? I mean, it gets really hot, I know. Or do you put nets over the thing, or doing something like
that? Most of my produce actually has a shade cloth over it right now. It's a big, huge green tarp, basically. The only full sunshine that is used in the garden pool is for the pond area with the citrus and the grapes. That gets full sunshine. Other than that, I have shade tarps that help it. And I take advantage of my south, I guess it's my north-facing wall, because that gets a lot of, shade all day long, and it stays cooler. And so I things that need more shade, I put over there. And I think that the thermal mass being, you know, partially underground really helps out quite a bit, too.
So what's next for the garden pool? Do you want to clue us in on any projects you might be bringing up?
Yeah, well, you know, hopefully we'll be pretty self-sufficient as far as water goes. That's my next huge project, and in my opinion, that's just as important as the garden pool, to be self-sufficient with not only food but water. Water is actually more important to me, in my opinion. So that's the next big project. It's a huge water catchment system and, you know, cistern. And then also I'm going to start brewing ethanol from the duckweed that we produce. You know, hopefully I can produce a good, strong batch. It actually has duckweed has 5 times more starch than corn.
Okay.
And it's kind of a new idea to produce ethanol from it. The Department of Energy has only been researching that since 2009, so kind of a hot topic there. I've also thought about making the garden pool a huge rain catchment system by adding you know, gutters around the base of it, piping into it. So, you know, got a lot of ideas. It's just a matter of time and, you know, money.
Yeah, absolutely. How many gallons would you say your system was, if someone would kind of put it in perspective?
I think in between 5,000 and 6,000 gallons of water that we raise fish in. We don't keep it fully stocked as much fish as we could, because I don't have the room to grow vegetative growth, so we have to use population control. So
yeah,
it's not, they're not totally full like most of your commercial aquaculture setups are. So
sure,
pretty neat setup.
That probably makes it a little easier to manage, though.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. We don't have the tight density, so, but we still get the food that we want out of it.
Now, do you preserve any of the fish by smoking or dehydrating or canning or something like that?
That's kind of next on my agenda, too, to learn how to preserve some of this. At this point, we pretty much don't need to, but, you know, we could certainly pull a bunch of fish out there and smoke it or dry it. I know there's a lot of methods. I just haven't learned them, but I'd like to learn them and, you know, post some of my YouTube videos up and show how we do that. But at this point, we pretty much fillet them with an electric knife and toss them in the freezer. So,
well, Dennis, I talked to him a little bit before the show, and he's agreed that if people had questions about aquaponics, we could possibly do a follow-up to this podcast where we could answer some of the aquaponics questions. So go to saveourskills.com and get your questions in there. And also, of course, get on gardenpool.org and like him on Facebook and watch his YouTube videos for sure. I think there are only 2 at the moment, but sounds like you have some plans to get quite a few out there.
Oh, yeah. Hopefully we'll keep providing more information out there, Nick. And, you know, thanks for the plug. I just want to say what a great idea Save Our Skills is. I worked at Home Depot for 10 years before I started my other ventures, and working there, you'd be surprised on how many people, you know, would walk up and need help for things that I would think that would be practical knowledge for everybody. But I think that it's a very important thing what you're doing, that our society could certainly benefit from learning the skills, that were common knowledge a few generations ago.
Well, that's one of my takes on it, because I'm one of those guys that comes in and asks those questions, and it makes you feel really helpless. It's really frustrating when you don't know, and it's not because someone like me is stupid, but it's all my focus was on learning how to computer program, learning how to, you know, advance my career, go through college, things like that. You know, raised as a city slicker. So really no emphasis on any of those types of skills growing up. And I kind of relate it to when I was decided I'd remodel my kitchen when I moved in. And I must have went to Lowe's 60 times while I was installing the sink, buying the wrong types of pipes. But, of course, you learn a lot through going through that. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. I really want to, you know, beef up this skill portfolio and kind of gain some control back in my life and become more self-reliant.
Well, my hat's off to you. That's a great ambition. So good job.
All right, Dennis. Thanks a bunch for kicking off the first podcast. And hopefully we're going to do this once a week. Next up, I'm going to be talking – like I said, to a guy who's going to give me the rundown on building battery banks for starting off your solar system. So look forward to that. Again, this has been Nick Ledoux, and thanks so much.